Hello?
Hi.
Good morning and welcome to Community Living Radio here on CITR UBC 101.9 FM. So this morning we have a guest with us. Her name is Dawn Carson, and she is the author of Practice Positive, A Simple Guide to Becoming a Positive, Happy Person. The book itself, as she describes it, is a love of labor. After surviving a debilitating breakdown in 2016, she began a journey of self-discovery, and she explored lots of different tools and techniques to manage anxiety and depression. She managed to get herself off of a few medications and everything, and the book kind of gets into all that sort of stuff. And gets into her feelings, her mindsets, and all that kind of stuff. Dawn also has a coaching practice called Radiant Mind Coaching, where she can help you with these sort of things. She's also a public speaker, and she gives a really inspiring talk about how to overcome things that could happen in your life. So, you know, with all these accolades and everything, and what Dawn does, why don't I just bring Dawn on right now. Dawn, are you there?
Yes, hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. It's been quite the interesting morning in Vancouver today, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I guess let's get into a little bit about your story.
Sure.
I mean, what was life like before 2006? And then maybe we can talk about what life was like after.
Sure. In the beginning of 2006, I was working as a personal trainer and attending school full-time to become a kinesiologist, so sports science. I also was managing a local rock band and holding up a very fast social life. I was always out. I was always busy. I was working two jobs as a personal trainer and a fitness instructor. So my life was very full, and I didn't have a lot of balance. I didn't really understand what the practice of self-care was. I thought I was doing everything right because I was in fitness and I was eating healthy, and I was considered a happy person.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very stressed out, and I was having a real trouble with things like saying no. So when someone asked me to take on an extra shift on my only day off that week, I would just say yes. I was an automatic yes person. And over the course of that year, I had a couple of really big hits. A debilitating loss of a family friend. Then I had a grandfather pass away. I moved. I quit working with the band. There was a lot of change. And if you take that stress indicator test, mine was through the roof in that 1 year. So by November, I was not able to cope, and it hit me very quickly. So what had happened was I basically went home from work one day and ended up having a massive anxiety attack. I was out of order for two full days. And then that just progressed from there. I had to stop going to school. I got depressed. I became suicidal. It became quite the downward spiral. And that's sort of how the breakdown began. And it was very quick, seemingly. But looking back, I can actually see it came from many, many years of just living wrong and not having balance and not knowing how to set boundaries and put myself first ever.
Right.
That's kind of where it came from.
So, what made you realize that you're having a breakdown?
Well, when I thankfully had moved back home with my parents, and my mom has a history of anxiety. So she recognized what I was having when I had my anxiety attack, because I didn't know what was happening to me. All of a sudden I was sitting in my chair and I couldn't move and I was filled with fear for no reason. And she recognized that part. But when I started having an anxiety attack every single day and I could no longer work and I could no longer go to school, my doctor was like, you are in trouble. Something's happening here. Mm-hmm. And when I couldn't pull myself out of it. And I was someone who was a survivor. So this was completely off the map for me. And I found that, okay, well, I'm trying not to be depressed, but the thoughts are just coming into my head and I don't want to be suicidal. I don't want to hurt myself, but the thoughts keep coming in my head. And that's when I knew I was out of control. I no longer had the faculties to keep myself okay.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So that just sounds scary, you know?
It was very scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's why I talking to friends and people that I was at church with at the time, they were like, it's okay if you go to the hospital. And so mm-hmm. I spent 6 weeks there.
It's okay. So you did spend time in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in the psych ward of the local hospital for 6 weeks. I was the longest one in the ward. Everyone else was turnaround like crazy, but I stayed for a very long time.
Wow. So I guess it was a situation where, consider all the stress and everything that you described ahead of that, mm-hmm. it was something that was needed?
Yeah, because I couldn't seem to come out of it on my own. I tried going to counseling and nothing was really working. And everything that used to give me peace or joy, I couldn't handle. I couldn't handle being around people, couldn't handle watching like light television shows, reading was difficult. So everything that normally would have kind of kept me grounded, I no longer had access to. So it was something that I felt very safe in that environment. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, then they pumped me full of medication. So the idea of me leaving didn't occur to me.
Yeah. Well, I guess that was going to lead into my next question. What was the treatment that they started to, during that 6 weeks?
Lots of medication. I was at one point on 12 high dose drugs. It was a lot of medication. And then there was other things there that I learned, which were a few of the tools that are in my book. There was an occupational therapist there named Jane who was amazing. And so she took us through things like art therapy and guided relaxation and mm-hmm. things that I had never encountered before. So there's definitely tools I learned there. But for the most part, I just was a zombie. I became very childlike, where my parents were constantly bringing me things like Spirograph and coloring books, and I really retreated into a childlike state while I was there, I guess as a coping mechanism.
Ooh, yeah, I guess everything else your brain was saying is no more, I can't take anymore. So
you
go through, they start this treatment inpatient, mm-hmm. and you spend 6 weeks inpatient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, at 6 weeks ends, you and now Dawn's back out of the hospital. And what happened there? You were released from the hospital. What happened next?
Well, before I actually was released from the hospital, it was very abrupt when I left. And what had happened was my psychiatrist had wanted to give me ECT treatment, which is basically shock therapy. And I watched a video of this happening, and I was super high on these medications. So I was like, I guess this is the next step. And thankfully, I thought to call my brother that day and just give him a heads up of what's going on. And then we had like a big family meeting at the hospital, and then I was basically taken out. So thankfully, I didn't have that happen. And when I left, I went back to my mom's house and I stayed there, and I just slowly wanted to get back into exercise, but I was so out of it that I couldn't walk for more than a week, for more than a block. And then I just have to turn around and walk, shuffle back. And I found that I was really completely disconnected from the world. And I realized, okay, something's got to give, because at the time I was 30 years old, and I, you know, that this isn't life. I can't survive this way. So I went to my family doctor and said, I'd like to start coming off some of these medications. Because when I left, I was on 10 very high dose medications. I was on, for example, 12 milligrams of lithium, and I had been put on that dose in the course of 6 days. So on top of everything else I was on, and my GP said that because she wasn't the prescribing physician, she couldn't actually take me off of those medications. And I guess because what had happened when I realized through talking to my family that this guy who had prescribed it was going to, like, electrocute me, I really tapped into the primal feeling of anger. It was the first feeling that I was able to experience during this situation. And I realized that if I went back to him, the anger would probably come up and I could harm him. So I told my mom, okay, well, I'm going to come off these on my own. I don't recommend anyone do that, but I did. I weaned myself off of 10 high-dose meds over the course of a year. A lot of it was just slowly coming off of one and then maybe adding it back a little bit and trial and error to see how I felt. Mm-hmm. And then when I came off of all the medications, I was still filled with anxiety and depression. And then I developed, like, social phobias and agoraphobia. I couldn't leave the house. And I developed all this other stuff that I hadn't had before. And I realized, well, I can't go back on the medications because I was a zombie. And what else can I do? And that's when I started just trying everything I could get my hands on, and reading, and trying different healing modalities and techniques, and that's where the meat of the book came from.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. So how long did this actually take before you actually started feeling like, okay, the anger's subsiding, the anxiety is subsiding, things like that?
It was probably about 2 years before I started feeling like I was a bit more normal, where I was doing more activities with people. Mm-hmm. My health was coming back. But the actual research was between 4 and 6 years long. So I was able to get back into a fairly regular routine in about the course of 2 years. I was able to start working part-time again at that time. And then I just kept doing the research. Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a long haul. For a long time, I got to a point where I didn't know how to trust myself. So I was so used to having to cancel plans last minute because I didn't feel okay that I actually had to call on my friends and say, okay, well, I'm actually doing better now, so you need to call me on it. If I cancel, make sure I'm canceling for a real reason, not just out of this habit I've developed.
Right.
Yeah, it was an interesting transition.
So you had lots of support.
I did. I'm very, very grateful. I had an incredible network of friends who were just there for me, and my family was 100% rock solid for me through it. It was hard for them because they didn't understand what was going on, but they definitely were very much there for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Kelly just joined us in the studio.
Okay.
So we're talking with Dawn Carson about depression and breakdowns and things like that, and what actually getting a story so we know what started to inspire her to actually sit down and write the book. So, you went through all this, Dawn, mm-hmm. and so how did you get down to actually putting pen to paper or in front of the keyboard, whatever the process took to get a book out?
Well, it sort of started, I had at some point in this journey discovered that I was actually really thriving, whereas life before was about surviving. Get through the next day, plan all your stuff, stay busy. And then now there had been a major shift in me and people were noticing and they were asking me, like, what are you doing? What's your secret? How is it that you're vibrant? Whereas before I was considered a very happy-go-lucky person, now there was something different people were noticing. And I had wanted to write. I had the thoughts in my mind throughout the journey that I really had wanted to write about what was going on, but I didn't know how to get from point A to point B. And I ended up going to a one-day course with a guy named Bob Burnham. He's a local author. Mm-hmm. And he did a course that was, I can't remember the exact name, but it was something like how to write a book in 40 days and self-publish. And so it was a four-hour course, best investment I've ever used. And it was, I came out of that and I had a template. I knew how to create a template to write a book and get my thoughts on paper. And then I became a machine and I wrote my book in 18 days. And then I, of course, everything else took longer. I had to do all the editing and the layout and self-publishing process, which was so beyond anything I'd ever done before. But a lot of people had been saying, you need to share this. How do you, you need to get the word out of this stuff that you're doing, because people would come to me with their issues and I had the answers for them. So that's kind of how it started. I just didn't expect it to be so quick to get out of me, because it was basically every night I was writing a three quarters of a chapter sort of thing. It was, yeah, couldn't turn it off.
Yeah. So, I guess we're gonna jump to a break here, okay. And then we're gonna get back with more questions about your book and what's actually in it and how it can actually help people.
Okay. Fabulous.
So we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing, really. Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because, of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a clothing.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture.
We're back. And we're back here with Dawn and Kelly is all ready to go here also, so he can join in the conversation.
Well, sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So Dawn, I guess when we went into the break, you were telling us about what inspired you to write the book, so, and a bit about the process of getting the book out. So let's continue with that.
Sure. So more to the inspiration of the book, I was really seeing that a lot of people had been kind of like me, living a lifestyle that was, they're kind of stuck in their little ruts of their world and not really practicing self-care, and there's a lot of negativity that I was encountering. And I had developed ways to not really feel that. Like, certainly you have slumps and I have bad days, mm-hmm. but most of my days weren't feeling like that anymore. And when people were coming to me saying, like, how do I deal with this really challenging person? Or how do I make it where I'm feeling less down all the time or frustrated all the time? I had kind of created a toolbox of sorts where I had tools that people could be using, but there's only so many people I can talk to in a day. And so this book idea was like, oh, well, you know what? When I was going through my breakdown, I found it very challenging to be reading, for one thing. And when you're in the darkest places of your life, it's really hard to be looking for a resource. But if I had found in my recovery time, if I had found one resource that had everything in it that I needed at that time, instead of having to consult like 50 books, which is basically about how much I read in the course of 2 years.
Wow.
And many of them were like the Encyclopedia of Natural Health, which is like 6,000 pages. And like, I had read such massive volumes, and a lot of it was in really technical jargon. And, you know, the vocabulary was really challenging when you're in that mind state. I thought, well, what if there was something that it was just have it on your shelf. And anytime you're feeling a little low or you're feeling like you're in a bit of a slump, you could just grab this book and it's easy to read. And it's, you can just look in the table of contents and kind of see, oh yeah, this is what I'm looking for today.
Yeah.
And if I'd had a resource like that, my recovery would not have taken as long as it did, because I would just had to do so much searching in the process and weeding through the stuff that didn't make a whole lot of sense and that didn't necessarily apply. So when I decided to write it, I really was very mindful of, okay, when I was in that situation, what did I need? What would have been beneficial for me to be able to find easily?
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can see some kind of an encyclopedia or almanac thing being, that's not a good resource when you need an answer now, right?
Yeah, it was very overwhelming trying to weed through that material. And then, of course, once you found the information, then you still have to go and do it. So it was a long time.
Right. So I did notice that out of your book, it's written in a very easy conversational sort of way, mm-hmm. Rather than diving into to techies or whatever the doctors talking,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's more really geared towards, hey, just pick up the book, get an answer, and maybe start the process of whatever the work is, right?
Exactly.
You wrote the book for people who just to have an easy look and start a fix. Not that it's going to be an easy fix. I'm not going to say that.
Right.
But it's a start to towards a fix.
Yeah. Or for sure. I mean, I could see if my parents had something to look to give me. Because I think a lot of times part of the problem is the people who are your caregivers or your support system, they don't have a clue how to help you. They have all the typical little words that they say, like, don't think like that, or, you know, just pull yourself out of it. And they're hoping to be very helpful, but it's not helpful. And so if they had planned to just be like, you know what, I think this is like something you might need, then they could just grab it, the person who it's been given to, and just kind of on their own time, in their own space, find healing. So yeah, I think it certainly is for the people who actually need the information, but it's also a good idea for someone who's got someone in their life that has maybe mental illness or is struggling with just really high stress, that they can maybe look in it and give ideas like, hey, I read this, maybe try this. We'll see how it goes, right? So
what does it feel like if you're in that dark place, as you put it, and somebody says, well, just snap out of it?
Oh, it's so frustrating. I remember, especially because when I was in the darkest place, I didn't have an understanding of emotion anymore. Everything had gone numb except for deep despair. It was the constant. I didn't have any other variation. And to give an example, I remember my mom and I would play dominoes. She had colored dominoes, which was good because I couldn't have counted to save my life at this time. And we actually had to put a towel down underneath him on the table so it was quieter, because at this time all of my senses were really peaked and magnified. So the idea of putting a pair of dominoes down on a wood table would feel like it was earth-shatteringly loud. And so we were playing dominoes one day, and it was just us in the living room. It was very quiet. And then my mom noticed that I was sobbing. I had not actually noticed, because I was so disconnected from my body that my eyes were just pouring tears, and I hadn't really noticed that it was happening. And so she wanted to know if we should stop. And I said, no, I think maybe my body is grieving for me, because I didn't know how to grieve. I just had this idea that, well, maybe it's doing something for me that I can't actually emotionally do. And she got it. So she knew how to listen. She was absolutely my rock. And then, unfortunately, people like my dad, who had never experienced anything like this before, he would say things like, just don't think bad thoughts. And I got to tell you, if I could have turned off those thoughts, I would have done it. But when I would sit in my living room late at night, because my sleep cycle was all off, I would just all of a sudden have this idea come in my head, like I could swallow all of the medications that are in our house, like all the Tylenol. And then I'd be like, where did that come from? That's not a thought I wanted to have, because I fully believe that we absolutely choose how we react to things. We absolutely choose our thought life, and we're in charge of that, and we can turn things off. However, if you're already in a place of massive depression, I don't really think you have that anymore, because I tried. I was doing everything I could to keep my mind on other things, and these little thoughts would just kind of jump in my head. It's almost like my brain had derailed.
Especially when you're trying to swallow lots of Tylenol, can be really hazardous as well.
Well, exactly. You know, this is not something I actually want. I did not want to hurt myself. But when someone's saying, oh, just cheer up, it's so completely unhelpful. Simply because you know you can't. If you could, you would have done that already. It's sort of a pat answer. And it's not their fault. I know that the people who are saying those things absolutely just want you to be better, but they don't know how to help you. And that's, you know, so you feel very disconnected. It felt very lonely and misunderstood and just lost.
So is it one of those things that if one person in the house or the family is going through depression, that everybody else is going to experience it with them?
Absolutely. I can't even imagine what it was like for my family. I can look at little instances. My younger brother was living with us at the time as well, and he I went through the weirdest phases, even when I first got home, where I had to wear pajamas all the time. I don't know why. And they were very colorful, very childlike pajamas that I bought. And I would get up and put clean ones on, so I was technically wearing new clothes. But it was, you know, he'd have friends come over, and it was embarrassing for him. And things like I always had to sit in the same spot. Even if they had been sitting there previously, when I came downstairs, I had to sit there. It was just really strange, extreme. Everything was about me, and there was just no choice, or I would wig out and have an anxiety attack, or I'd just start crying for no reason. And so I think it was very, very challenging for them to have to witness this and not have a clue why it was. And they probably felt like, well, what the heck? Like, get over it. Or, you know, I can imagine that I would probably have felt that way. And then I've got my stepdad and I used to have really cerebral conversations, and all of a sudden I couldn't listen to anything intellectual. I just would shut down and be like, please make him stop talking. And it was definitely a challenge for everyone that was around me.
When I was a little kid, I used to wear pajamas, and I just, you know, jump up and down the bed and just like didn't care about during daytime and just know that kind of thing. So,
it was very regressed straight state. It was, very challenging, I'm sure, for everyone involved. And I think it was very scary, because I'm technically, normally, I'm a very chatty person. I have a lot to say. I have lots of ideas. And I became very silent during this period. My mom, even, I remember we were driving one day, and she said, wow, you're just really quiet. But I had almost no thought in my head at this time, because it was such a, especially when I was on medications, it just was just numb and void. And so I know it was really challenging for everyone.
And it sounds like a completely different person than who you are today.
Yeah.
Because you definitely are not as you're describing, as you recovered. Mm-hmm. So, what is it like now when you look back at it and speaking about it, all this right now? What is that like for you?
Sort of surreal. It's sort of hard to believe it even happened because I'm such a completely different person. But I'm incredibly grateful for it happening because I really didn't know that I was on the wrong path and the wrong track for myself. Mm-hmm. And I was in an industry that I now have no desire to be involved in. It felt very superficial and people just wanted to look a certain way. Whereas now I'm able to really get into a deeper level with people and there's more authentic relationship being built. And even in my friendships, I used to have a lot of guy friends, mostly I think because it was surface friendships. We didn't often get into the nitty gritty of life. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun mm-hmm. together, but it wasn't forging really deep relationships. And since this has happened, it has completely transformed my idea of what friendship even is. And it's also really deepened my relationship with my family where I'm just really raw and honest. And I don't care who knows that this happened. And there's a lot of humor in it too. So, you know, I can look back and think, wow, what the heck was that? You know? So it's an interesting thing to look back on and talk about. I don't have any emotional, like I feel bad about it or anything at all. It just feels like, wow, that's exactly what I needed to have happen to me. I needed basically to have my whole life squashed so that I could completely grow out this new being out of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, how are you actually using that past experience to help others move forward through their recovery?
Well, the first thing I think is that a lot of people who struggle with either depression or anxiety or stress or negativity or any mental illness, most of them don't seem to have a voice. And I found that, like, I have family members and friends who certainly struggled with things, not necessarily as extreme as my situation was, but certainly they have struggled with these things. And they don't talk about it. It's awkward. They'll talk to me about it because I'm so open. But most people don't. There's a stigma. If it's in your head, it's weird and you don't want to talk about it. You don't want anyone to know. And for me, I really feel it's important that if you feel you can talk about it, you absolutely have to talk about it. You need to be breaking down those boundaries and making it where it is easier for others. You kind of pave the road there for them to feel like it's a bit more safe to be discussing this and being open and honest and realizing what your options are. Mm-hmm. And when I work with clients or groups, I create an environment that you're able to be vulnerable and it's safe and that it's 100% accountability between myself and them, the people in, if it's a small group within that little group, but it's a very safe environment because when you're in a safe environment, all of a sudden change can occur. Whereas if you don't feel like you can be vulnerable, you're not going to be peeling any layers away at all. You're going to have that wall up. So when I work with people one-on-one or in groups, and then what I will be doing more of with public speaking to large groups, I want to create an environment where vulnerability absolutely can occur and that it's in a fun way. It doesn't have to be all scary and, you know, disconcerting. It can absolutely be fun. You can create activities and have partnerships, and it can be a really wonderful experience. But it takes work, and if the person's willing to do the work, that's really all that's necessary.
Yeah. So I imagine it takes a lot of work to make sure that you are developing a safe environment. Mm-hmm. How do you go about that? What do you do to help people feel safe so that they can just share?
The first thing I do is I tell parts of my story. And throughout the whole process, I am sharing tidbits of things that I went through so they understand. First of all, I've been there and quite possibly in a darker place than they've been. And because my story is so extreme, most people haven't had to go to the extremes of being in a psych ward for 6 weeks. So, you know, they might have found other ways to cope and they mm-hmm. keep it sort of in a certain parameter, and if they can see that someone who had such a massive experience, and I'm, you know, it's far more than I've shared today, when I'm able to share that stuff, they can see that, oh, well, she can talk about it. I could talk a little bit about my stuff too. And I, especially in a group environment, I basically make it a contract. You have to sign that whatever is disclosed here stays here. And right. You'll basically be ousted if you divulge anything or make a person feel badly or try to shut them down of what they're saying or contradict. It's sort of a balance. You're sort of watching, and it's like you're a teacher in some ways, where you're in a little class of kids where people are starting to squabble. You just kind of, okay, remember we're respecting this person, or, you know, just let them go through their process. Just reminding, gentle reminders. And most times I find that people, if you're all there for the same kind of reason anyways, vulnerability can happen. I mean, I've been to other people's events where it's sort of that feeling where everyone's sort of light mind, where they're coming to this thing for a reason, and your reasons don't all have to be the same, but your focus is the same. Like, I want to gain something out of this, and if I'm able to talk about it, they can talk about it, and maybe I can learn from them, and so on and so forth.
Don Carson, who is the author on a story on mental illness and depressions, is on Community Living Show. We're going to go and take a break for now, and we're going to be back with more discussions with Don. Is that okay, Don?
Yes, thank you.
All right, so we'll be back in a moment on the NCRA Radio Networks and on Community Living Show.
On December 18th, for one night only, come see formerly on hiatus Vancouver band SSRIs reunite live at the Wise Hall. The lineup will feature the membership of the 2010 LP Effeminate Godzilla-sized Wind Chimes. Don't go see Star Wars, come see SSRIs reunion show. Guest bands include TV Ugly, Blessed, and Redrick Sultan. Tickets are $10. Check out the SSRIs on Facebook for more information. This is one night only, so don't miss out.
The New Testament.
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What is Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Virginia.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
And before we before we go up to the Don Carson, we would like to give our best sympathies to our person who does the show on Fridays, Nargwar, the human serviette, who had just had a stroke last week. And give my best Community Living Show gives our best wishes to Nargwar, who so had a stroke last week. So he's on the mend, so he will be back again on the show, on our flagship station, CITR. We wish you all the best on Nargwar. Anyways, back to Don Carson. Anyways, honor Arthur of the story on mental illness and depressions.
Yeah. You can say the name of your book again, Don.
Positive, A Simple Guide to Becoming a Positive and Happy Person.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's has her coaching practice, which is Radiant Mind Coaching.
Yeah.
So I guess let's start talking about, because you had some notes in your book about mindsets. So let's start talking about that. How does mindset help people come out of these places?
Sure. We'll actually touch on the title. The reason why I called it Becoming a Positive and Happy Person, a lot of people think that's redundant. And actually, the reason why I put that is I was a happy person before my breakdown. I was absolutely happy-go-lucky. I thought enjoying life, but positive is not the same thing. So happy is very much an emotion. It's mm-hmm. fleeting. It can come and go. If you have a death of a loved one, you're not going to feel happy. No matter how hard you try, you're not going to be happy in that instant. You're not going to be happy if you all of a sudden lose your job or whatever comes up in your life that's a struggle. Happiness isn't a part of that.
No. And I learned that. I pretty much learned that during my teens as well, in my depression years.
Exactly. So the angst is there. You can't have both at the same time. You can feel basically mm-hmm. one major emotion at a time. Positive is a little different. So you can absolutely feel positive. That can be an emotion, but it's also a mindset. So mm-hmm. you can choose, no matter what is going on in your life, to see a positive spin. And it's not always happy and exciting when that happens. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. My cat died in August of last year. Mm-hmm. And this was basically my fur baby. I don't have kids. So she very much was my child and very suddenly was taken from me. I really was debilitated from that. It really just destroyed me emotionally. However, in that time, I was able to kind of see little things like, well, it's less stress for me because she was behaviorally had issues. She would, you know, pee on the floor instead of in the litter box. And, there was things with it that was causing me stress. And certainly that was taken away of the equation. That didn't make me happy to think that. So I would try to set it down. No, I don't want to think of the benefit of losing her. And then things like I have another cat who actually was obese, and I was a little concerned for his health. And if she had survived, I would not have been able to have him get his weight down, just with the feeding schedule and things. So there was little positives that were coming up that were very frustrating at the time. But because I have built a mindset that is very positive predominantly, when I was going through my grief, these mm-hmm. little thoughts were coming into my mind. And right. so I didn't want to hear them then. But as I came through that grief and processed it and worked through different therapies to do that, those thoughts came back. And now I'm able to see that, you know, I'm just really thankful for the time I had with her. My stepdad said this beautiful thing. He just said, she was pure love and light, and that's all you were meant to have from her. And so that there were little things that through that process, it was sort of wheeling away at the grief. And now I'm able to look at it from a completely different perspective. Mm. If that had happened to me before I had built my positive mindset system into my life, I would not have had that to be able to lean on. And so things like when I've really struggled with finances, I've been able to just trust that it'll work out. I have to know that. There's just no reason for it not to. At some point, things have to turn around because that's what I'm focusing on. So what you focus on creates your world. And if you're focusing constantly on the things that are bad or struggles or frustration, which looking back, that's exactly how I lived my life. It was always, when's the next shoe going to drop? How am I going to ever get through all this stuff I have to get to do? How am I ever going to make ends meet? How am I ever going to blah, blah, blah? Mm. I was always thinking on the negative spin as opposed to the positive spin. So although I was happy, I was not positive. And now the reverse is true. Sometimes I'm not happy, but I absolutely can just see the way the world can be. And I can mm-hmm. see possibility where I didn't see that before.
Yeah. So, yes, every time I've seen you, I don't know if you've always been happy, but I know you've always been positive.
Yes.
Just a little bit about history between me and Dawn. We've actually gone through, I think, at least three personal development classes in personal and business development classes together, haven't we?
Yeah, I think at least three, maybe four.
Yeah, and she's always been the one. Is like, well, if you look at it this way, you can see the positive part to what's going on. It may be a problem, but there's always the positive light to it. You've always been the one to point that out in all the classes. So it explains a lot of about how you see things, because.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, she's always so positive about stuff.
It's a lot of times it's just about asking yourself the right questions. Instead of a how am I ever going to leading question, it can be how can I make this better? How else can I see this? If you're struggling mm-hmm. with a frustrating person, how can I see them in a way that is different. What could possibly be causing them to be this way? Or, you know, it's just asking yourself more questions, because most people just don't do that. We usually go through life and we just sort of are on a track, and we allow life to happen to us instead of making life happen and being more of a part of that process.
Right. It is really important to make sure that we keep that positive up, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, and it's a practice. The reason why I called it practice positive is because if you practice daily, just a few things every single day, if you're incorporating that into your life, it becomes a practice of being positive. So it's not as hard when things do come up that are struggling, that you struggle with. It is already built into your system of your life, and it's less difficult then because you've already got it in place.
Right. So, I mean, all things considered, how long did it actually take you to get to the point, though?
Between 2 and 4 years. Like, I know that I was able to get back to work after about 2 years' time, but where I felt like it was just sort of a part of me was probably closer to 4 years. But mostly because it took so much time for me to learn it all. I didn't have anyone teaching me. I was sort of doing it on my own, and I didn't know what my goal was either. So I think that coming from a place where you're working with someone who you already know what your goal is to create a more positive mindset or reduce your stress or reduce your negativity. If you're already coming from that mindset, it wouldn't take that long. Obviously, if you're in the fits of depression, it's going to take a process to come get you out of that. And you do need to make sure you have the resources and the support system in place to have that. But the actual practice of building clients I've worked with, it hasn't taken that long. Within 6 sessions of them really doing the work, they're starting to see shifts. So it's not something that has to take a ton of time, as long as you're willing to keep it very, very much a practice where you're doing the work regularly every day.
Yeah. So can you kind of describe some of the steps that you take people through?
Sure. The very first thing is we talk about erasing negativity. So you can't fill up an already full tank. And most people's tanks tend to be full of negative already, and they don't even know where it's all coming from. So the things you listen to, the things you read, like the music you listen to, the words you're saying about yourself, the people you're spending time with, everything, we're affected by everything in our environment. So it's taking small steps to sort of just start looking at what am I reading, for one, because when we're reading, we're taking in so much information and our mind is creating this world with it. Words are such a big part of this, that you look at that and think, okay, well, if I'm reading only very graphic, horrifying imagery, I probably should balance that out at least with some positive information. And at some point, maybe get rid of that entirely. Totally up to the individual. If you're only watching TV shows that are incredibly violent or explicit in nature, that's not a balance. And so you need to at least, at a very minimum, balance that out with something light and humorous or romantic or whatever your choice is. It's sort of like a scale. Like if you think of the that lady with the scales, you want to have it basically where at the very bare minimum they are balanced, and absolutely optimally would be that they're completely to the positive side the majority of the time. So when you're looking at the things you're bringing into your life through people and media and so on, you want to look at, okay, let's take one area of my life that I feel like is the most negative, and let's start chipping away at that. Let's find ways to reduce that. So once you've done some of that work, you can start entering in tools on top of that. The very first tool I give everyone is a gratitude journal. Mm-hmm. And I practice gratitude daily without fail. The few times I haven't is when I'm like sick and not awake. So gratitude is huge. I'm actually doing a 31-day challenge this month on Facebook. Just what am I grateful for today? Just to help people kind of get prompted. What am I thankful for? What am I thankful for?
Yeah,
that's the very first one I do for sure.
Same goes with Thanksgiving. I do kind of a thing called 3 things that you're thankful for.
Yeah.
Similar thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if you do that daily, your life transforms. Truly, gratitude, it sounds like this glib little, oh, the attitude of gratitude and, you know, be thankful. But it is actually incredibly powerful. And it's the one thing I can say was the biggest turnaround for me the quickest when I started practicing three things before bed, three things when I woke up that I was grateful for. It started to shift.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because I can see how that would work. You know, you're focused on what you have, not what you don't have.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some of the other tools that you go through?
I look at different therapies I can refer out to. So I'm a huge believer in hypnotherapy. I've gone to three different practitioners for it, and it's really great for reducing if your breakdown or your depression or whatever you're going through is from a very strong experience, it can absolutely reduce that experience, the emotional attachment to that experience. So I often will refer out to things like that. But personally, I have them it depends on what they're needing. So if they're in the workplace and there's stress around work, that's an issue and it has to do with other people.
Right.
I teach a tool where it's like a bubble of protection. Right. And so the person imagines them wrapped in a bubble, and they can pick the color of it. They can pick if it's warm or cool, whatever feels right for them. And then you play with this bubble. So you basically think, okay, I'm going to just push this bubble out so it's a bit bigger, and where it pushes past all of the people. And in however big it could be, the earth-wide sort of thing, however big you want to have it, that's your barrier of protection. And so you fill it only with loving energy, and you fill it with warmth, and you fill it with a feeling of security and safety. And then when you go out into your day, you just have it in the back of your mind. Like, you can't be touched by the other people's stuff because you're completely surrounded by this bubble of protection and security and safety and love and whatever emotion you need attached to it at that time. Yeah. So I have a few people in my life who I know that when I'm in their company, I always have issues with them for whatever reason, whether it's an incredibly negative person or they tend to be bitter or whatever the reason is. There are a few people that every time I know I'm going to be seeing them, I just sort of place this bubble around myself.
Yeah.
And it's just in your mind. Very powerful tool.
Yeah. I hate to cut you off, but we're starting to run short on time.
I was going to ask one more question.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Kelly.
What about some issues like panic attacks, that kind of thing?
Yes. So panic attacks, it's very, very scary. If you're by yourself, we tend to try to breathe and it's all in our chest and that's where all the constriction is. So if you actually, as you breathe in, push your belly out and focus on that, it tends to draw the air down better.
Yes.
And the other thing is, honestly, there's a breathing technique called 4-7-8, where you breathe in for a count of four and hold it for seven beats, and then you breathe out for eight. That actually reduces your blood flow. It reduces your heart rate, and it allows you to calm down. If you're even able to do it a couple of times, it can reduce.
It was the same issue with my mom, because she has plenty of panic attacks, and of course both my parents separated when I was in my late teens, and she had major panic attacks at that time, even though my dad was stubborn and my family wasn't all that really good at the time, but that's another story altogether. But anyways, it's very interesting about the panic attacks.
So can you give what is your message to the world, Dawn?
My main message is, it's entirely possible to live a life where no matter what is going on in your world, you can have a positive mindset about it, and you can shift everything just using very simple tools like the gratitude journal. I challenge everybody, do a gratitude journal. Write it down three times in the morning, three times in the evening that you're thankful for, and start to see how things shift. You'll find more things to be grateful for. And if you use tools like that, you can absolutely change the landscape of your whole world. I have made it where in my life, the majority of the people I see the majority of time, it's an incredible experience. It's very rare that I encounter people now that I don't somehow affect positively.
How we can't contact you?
They can go to my website, www.doncarson.com. And they can also find me on Twitter. It's at Don with a capital D and underscore Carson with a capital C. And I'm also on Facebook if they just look up Don Carson. I'm the one that's the author.
Cool. So we're pretty much out of time. Thank you very much, Don.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Yep.
Take care now.
Bye.
Bye now.
And that was Don Carson.
I locked it.
There we go.
That's better.
So yeah, so that's Don Carson.
Technical issues with the phone.
Yes.
So yeah, did you have any other announcements before we go?
We're just waiting. Well, of course, we did our Access Television on the Canucks Autism Network last Sunday. So we're just waiting for the process of the taping and everything. So.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
All the editing and the post-production stuff.
Yeah, we're hoping to do an Access Television next month where we are doing have Marie Kearns on the show and talk about, and not only her, but maybe the co-producer as well on the actual thing that she did was the Tales of Mirthawell. So hopefully we'll have that on next month on Access TV. So
yeah,
that's in the process, and hopefully we will have it on audio, but a lot of the characters are on visual, so you have to really have to watch it on television.
I actually got to watch her make one of the characters walk across, I guess it was like a temple or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, so it's going to be a little bit of a demo there where she's doing the drawings of Tales of Mythical. It'll be very interesting, so stay tuned for that on Shaw TV. It's on Channel 4 if you get cable, so there you go. Yeah. And that is it?
Yep, and I guess we're up to the next show.
Yes, so stay tuned to your next shows on NCRA Radio Networks. We'll be back again next week. Full hour tomorrow. I will not be here tomorrow, so I don't know what you're doing tomorrow.
We'll probably do a replay, and I'm trying to gather up because we're getting close to Christmas.
Okay.
True. I'm trying to gather up some people to maybe have...
some experts on Christmas?
Christmas music, you know.
Yeah, that too, but I'm just saying, I'm just wondering if you have some sort of experts on...
We had Santa a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, we did. It was fun.
You know, yeah. But, you know, I also wanted to talk about, because kind of